Hello, my name is Rich Jones. I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and the chief clinical officer of U-Turn Health. And I'm also a co-host of this wonderful podcast.
And my name is Liz, and I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and a co-host of You Learn, You Turn.
And let's get the show on the road. Welcome, everyone. This is Rich Jones from U-Turn Health, and welcome to our podcast, You Learn, You Turn. Today, I'm joined by Chris Thompson. Chris, thank you for being part of this.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks so much, Rich.
I'll real quick orient you to the audience so you know who you're talking to. We have a lot of people in recovery who listen to our podcast, but we also have a lot of people who are new to the recovery conversation, new to issues around addiction and kind of learning their way around it. And a lot of people who work in other professions like just the commercial space and different businesses and in healthcare. So we're really just trying to spread the word on what recovery is all about, the fact that it doesn't discriminate. It touches all of our lives. And so to that end, tell us a little bit about what brings a nice guy like you to a podcast like this.
Yeah. Well, I guess why I'm qualified is I'm someone who's burned my life to the ground due to my own battle with addiction. And now I'm fine.
Now, isn't that weird that that's what qualifies you to be on here? That's kind of
yeah. Well, I mean, I try to own it. I've been at healthcare conferences where someone's like, I'm ex-CEO of Optum, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm Chris and I'm ex-chronic alcoholic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Just own it, you know?
Yep. So tell us your story a little bit.
Yeah. Thanksgiving Day 2018, I woke up on the sidewalk for the fourth day in a row. Mm. No phone, no wallet. It had rained the night before, which it hadn't rained in like months in LA. And that was my rock bottom. But you know, fortunately for me, the right people showed up for me at the right time. And they gave me hope that could be day one of my comeback story. And for the last 5 years, that's been true.
How did so when you say the right people showed up at the right time, first off, were you from LA? Was that home to you? How did you wind up in that situation?
I had gone to LA to go to a treatment center.
Oh, okay. I got you.
A few months before. Yeah. Yeah.
From where? From what part of the country?
Philly.
Oh, you're the whole way from Philly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why LA from Philly?
I called a hotline and that's how you know it. You know the story. You know the drill.
Yeah. Oh man. So you probably Googled I need help or whatever.
Yeah.
And just to orient the audience, like Chris and I are kind of like joking about this, but what will typically happen, and you can tell me if this was the case, several different treatment centers, probably like several pages worth of treatment centers come up when you search, and then you find yourself on the phone with one of them.
Yeah. Well, for me, I didn't know I was talking to a specific treatment center. I thought like it was a Google PPC, you know how it goes. First phone number that came up, I called, it was a 1-800 number. I called it and it was like it positioned itself as a resource hotline, but I learned later it was just ad for a treatment center. So
wow. So if you don't mind, like what were you up to at the time? What were you using and how bad had it gotten? And like, was this your first time ever reaching out for any kind of help?
This was my first time being bold or brave enough to go to a treatment center because, you know, I used to have nightmares or like I had caved and called a treatment hotline, you know, in my addiction, because that was one of my biggest fears, was being that guy who went to rehab. And for me, it was primarily alcohol because I didn't have consistent enough income for other things I liked. So, you know, alcohol was the primary thing, but of course, you know, whatever I could get my hands on.
Yeah. So you call them up and you're just doing your thing. You're trying to check it out. And then can you talk a little bit about what it was like on that end? Were they like, let's get you on a plane, or how did they approach you?
Yeah. They bought me a plane ticket for the
next. And you got the whole nine, dude.
Yeah. I called at 10 PM, was on a flight by 6 AM.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So if we could talk about that for a minute, because if you're out there listening, folks, this experience, now I don't know that it's going on quite as often as it used to. How long ago was this, Chris?
5 years ago.
Yeah. So, and I used to hear this all the time. People would call and then the next thing you know, you're on a plane. And I guess on one hand, it was kind of good that you were going to treatment, but talk us through what happens then.
Yeah. So one of the big lessons I had to learn, which I've heard in, you know, some of the rooms of AA and any other similar support programs, is that treatment is not recovery. And I kind of went with the perspective, the naive perspective, that, you know, I have a problem that I haven't been able to solve. Let's see if the healthcare professionals can solve it.
Yeah.
Is kind of, you know, the perspective I went there with. And day one out of treatment, I relapsed. And yeah, that led to my final and worst run ever. I mean, looking back, like, you know, a lot of the things that happened for me or the path I took, it's definitely, I wouldn't recommend the same path. But, you know, I'm, you know, it took what it took to get where I got. And I can't necessarily say that, you know, had I called it different, ended up in Florida instead of LA, or ended up in Philly, you know, I would just, you know, it's hard to have regret,
right,
with, you know, how things have played out since then.
Yeah, because you started the process at that point. I mean, something was going to be different after you made that call.
Yeah. And it was honestly waking up on the sidewalk for the fourth day in a row in LA with nowhere to go. Yeah. That was where I needed to get to.
Yeah.
In order to, you know, fully embrace recovery with humility, and also recognize that my recovery is dependent on what I do outside of treatment. It's dependent on the relationships I build. It's dependent on, you know, the daily work. It's dependent on, you know, if you have diabetes, it may or may not be your fault, but you got to follow the treatment plan.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's the same thing with addiction. Like, you know, you got to put in the daily work the same way you got to eat right if you have diabetes, or you got to work out. It's not a blame game. It's just only you can take responsibility.
It's just reality. It's just the truth. And it's so weird in today's world now, because everything is, you know, controversial, and there's all these different opinions on stuff. And I'm the type of person who believes in multiple pathways of recovery. I don't care how you get better, just get better. Mm-hmm. I don't care whether it's moderation for some people. For me, I choose total abstinence as my pathway. Where did you come down with that type of stuff?
Yeah. For me, it landed on abstinence, just because once I put anything in me, that's when the craving really
starts. Yeah.
And, you know, some people may have, you know, not, you know, damaged themselves to the extent that I did, or may not have the same addictive mind that I do, or may have gone through a rough period and they're able to successfully moderate. I tried that. You know, I tried beer only. I tried, you know, avoiding Coke. I tried, you know, all the different.
Drinking only on the weekends, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
So you make a decision.
Honestly, I was good at only drinking on the weekend. I just didn't know when the weekend would end.
So. I had a different definition of a weekend.
Yeah. Like, I knew better than to start drinking on a Monday.
Right.
Like, I started drinking on a Friday. I didn't know when I was going to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. So you land in LA. Do you know people in LA too, or was it solely just for the treatment center that you went out there?
I knew no one.
Wow.
When I landed there. Yeah.
So did you complete the treatment center?
Yeah. and a few more in the few months that came after that. You know, it was like 3 or 4 treatment centers within 2 or 3 months. And
then, oh, okay.
And then landed where I landed Thanksgiving 2018. So
you went out there for one treatment center, but then there were others that you went to while you were there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you have? Did you have insurance or something? You just figured out how to get yourself in and all that kind of good stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even have to know how to get back in because, like, I get out of treatment. They put me in a sober living. I relapse while I'm in sober living. The sober living sends me back to a rehab that they have relationships with.
Yes.
And, you know, yeah. Yeah.
And you keep going back and you keep going back until. And I guess I see the logic behind that, I guess. Sometimes I wonder about that, though.
Yeah, well, I know certain things now. So.
You know certain things now, for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, like you said, it took what it took to get you where you got. And there's a lot of gratitude that you know, for that you're in recovery and stuff. But what's your take on that whole experience, just from the treatment center side and... I mean, think about it even beyond your own experience, just for the way that they run that stuff. It's kind of wild. Get a plane ticket, get on a plane, fly to LA, and then you're boom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, there's, I'm sure, some good places out there.
Yes.
But my holistic view is that treatment rehab in the U.S. has sold a false and predatory lie, is my holistic view.
Yeah.
You know, I later learned that the treatment set or the sober living was making more money when people relapsed and because of the referral relationships that they have. So, you know, it's and so misaligned incentives there. There was fraud that was ran on my insurance from that sober living that I didn't find out till 2 years later after 2 years of fraud. When I get a collections call, because my insurance had lapsed. You know, the last treatment center I ever went to, it was me and one other guy, like doors that basically just opened. And the other guy told me he was being paid by the admissions director.
Yeah. I've heard of that. I've absolutely heard of that. Man.
Yeah. So in terms in, you know, through that journey in part of, where I'm grateful is within that 3 months of treatment hopping, I saw kids who had been to 30 treatment centers.
I bet
over 4 or 5 years. You know, I saw really quickly how I didn't want to end up.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, treatment centers, if they're in the fee for service world, there's no reason for them to not want to see repeat customers.
It's tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's tough. And so we have, there's a reality of the situation and I want to go and I want to say on the record that I have good friends that work in treatment. I've worked in treatment. I worked in private treatment for a bunch of years. And I mean, I believe in the work that gets done there. I just think that it's fraught with peril, man. Like this story that you're telling me is not, people think that I'm being overly dramatic when I say this, you know, that, oh, you're just trying to cause problems, Rich, and stir the pot. But this story is not uncommon. I've heard this story of get a plane ticket, get on a plane now and get out to California 20 times, 25 times.
Yeah. Yeah. And then once you're there, that's how everyone got there.
How everyone got there.
Yeah.
And then you just get passed around from treatment center to treatment center.
Yeah. 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 You know, it's kind of the equivalent to, you know, you're about to walk into what you hope to be life-saving heart surgery, and then you find out that your heart surgeon has a referral relationship with the morgue.
Yeah.
and there's actually more incentive for them to be less successful, which, you know, I know of a provider or two who has a underground life insurance arm of their operations. So you truly, but all you will see is you will see the fact that they spent the most on Google ads. That's all you will see. And you will see that how much dollars went into their marketing videos. That's all you will see. And, you know, you don't have to be a healthcare professional to launch a treatment center. It doesn't cost a ton of money to launch a treatment center. And that's just, you know, what saddens me is, you know, there's just so many people out there who, you know, they may have a loved one and they thought they won the battle or won the war when they finally got their little Johnny to go to rehab. But you don't know what kinds of operations are behind.
And you won't find out either.
Yeah.
So if you're a parent, because my daughter's gone through treatment. If you're a parent, they put the patient on what's called like a blackout, meaning you can't even talk to the person for a period of time. And then when you do, if they don't sign a release of information, you're getting zero information on them. And even if they do, you're kind of held out of it. I don't care what anyone says. You're as a family member, you're held at arm's length. Mm-hmm. And if you're a parent, especially if you're a parent and it's your insurance plan that's paying for it, you should be included, I would think. Mm-hmm. That story that you told, the only thing I can say about it is, unfortunately, Chris, far too often that's ended it like in the absolute worst outcome. The person has died on the streets of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So you wake up 4 days late, like fourth day in a row. What happens? Like, why? How do you not wind up with that tragic story?
Yeah. So, you know, fortunately, I'd heard enough phrases in AA, like treatment isn't recovery. Your best thinking got you here.
Yeah.
Alcohol is not your problem. It's your only solution. And, you know, enough people swearing that, you know, working the 12 steps saved their life. And fortunately, I've been there long enough to have been to enough AA meetings to where, you know, when I was finally able to get a hold of a phone, you know, the right people showed up for me. And, you know, the decision I made that day, and everyone's path looks different, but the decision I made that day is, I don't know if I'm ever going to drink again, but before I do, I'm going to do everything that these people said worked for them.
Okay.
And that was the unlock, was that kind of willingness to just forget everything I think I know and just, you know, stick with the people who are walking this path.
Yeah. And these were recovering people. And so this didn't involve going, you had been to treatment already, but this didn't involve going back to treatment. It involved what? Just doing recovery related activities and things like that.
Yeah. And it did involve going to treatment one last time.
One last time. So you go back. Okay.
Yeah. And that's where I met the guy who was being paid to be there.
Yeah.
I was their client number one at the facility. And, you know, I really quickly got a sponsor, and you know, as a result of working with him, you know, that's what saved my life, was the opportunity to work with him. You know, the treatment center was just a place to stay while I worked with my sponsor.
Yeah.
Went to AA meetings and started building the daily habits that have kept me sober today.
And then how long were you in that last, how long did that last stay last? Was it 30 days or?
Yeah. So I was there for 30 days and I went into a sober living. And I was in a sober living the next year and a half.
So you're sober living there for a year and a half. All right. And then it kind of, for lack of a better term, it sort of sticks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. And what would you attribute that to if you had to? I mean, I could sit here and kind of put words in your mouth, but what would you attribute that to?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually after I got out of treatment, it was Christmas Eve, and I started working on Sober Sidekick. I started coding for it. And 30 days after that, I actually got my 60-day chip that day. Apple approved the MVP of Sober Sidekick in the App Store.
Had you been thinking about it before all this, I guess?
No.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it kind of popped into my head Christmas Eve. I had nothing better to be doing. So that gave me a sense of purpose.
Okay.
To work on something. So I had a sense of purpose. I had a newfound recovery community. I was going to meetings every day. I had an amazing sponsor, and left and right around me were examples of how I didn't want to end up, So like staying in sober living and seeing people go in and out, multiple people died while I was in the house. I was in one scenario where I was first on the scene giving CPR. They don't wake up. So it's, it was after that perspective shift that had happened, I was kind of using everything around me as a learning experience of, how I don't want to end up, and seeing the themes of, one guy is staying sober in this,
yeah,
and he's doing this, this, and this. So I'm going to do that. Everyone else is, watching Netflix all day, hooking up, like all these focused on all these things that, aren't their recovery, and then they're dying. So it was kind of that realization that like, this is life and death. This is, a battle. And we are in the trenches.
Yeah. Yeah. I ran a recovery house. I ran a sober living program for a while. It's the hardest job in the world. It's like, you just got, cause it's what you just said. It's totally up to the, You can't really control the outcome in a rehab. I can pretty much keep anybody sober. I'm just not going to let you leave, and I'm not going to let anybody come in and see you, and we'll keep you sober. But in a sober living place, you got to have a certain level of internal motivation. And you did. It sounds like you developed that. So you're going and you're doing your thing and you're trucking along. And tell us about Sober Sidekick and tell the audience a little bit more about it so they understand what we're talking about with that part of the equation.
Yeah. So recognition of how lucky I was to have the relationships with people who are not being paid to be in my life. You're not, being paid to take my call at 1 a.m., the way they showed up for me, recognizing how lucky I was. I wanted to create a world where connecting with the right people at the right time is no longer up to chance. And I wanted to tap into that intrinsic willingness that alcoholics and addicts have to help other alcoholics and addicts. So came up with this app that is built on karma and empathy,
basically,
where the more support you are giving others, the more support you're receiving. And no one ever goes without support. These were all like the theories. And, the theory was like, if this algorithm works, this means that anyone in the world can write a post at 2 a.m. and within minutes, if not seconds, at least one person is going to reach out to them with written support in that moment, who has raised their hand and like, I'm going to support this guy.
I'll orient everybody real quick, guys, just so you know exactly how this works, because I'm on the app. So you go on the app and you go to post like you would on any other social media platform. But before you can post, it kicks you out and says, before you post, please respond and offer some support. And it has better language than that. And then that gets me, I got to put a comment on somebody's support, give them a shout out on somebody's post, and then I can post my stuff. And that leads to a situation where, unlike other social media platforms where somebody could put something up and get zero attention, at the very least, you're going to engage one other person. I love that stuff.
Yeah. Because isolation is the enemy. People don't relapse in treatment or therapy sessions or even AA meetings, typically they relapse in the moments when people are alone.
Yeah.
And those are the moments that we have to optimize for.
Yeah. And you don't want to be the only, I mean, I don't want to be the only dude on a sober app that doesn't have anybody saying anything to him. Be like, what the hell is wrong with me, man? I can't even get noticed on the sober app, man. And the other thing about it is that I've seen a lot of these apps. I've test driven a lot of apps. It seems like you got like you have a lot of members. How many users do you have and things like that?
Nearing 400,000.
Wow. That's got to be one of the most utilized. Like, I don't know if they keep track of that as far as like sober social media goes and stuff, but that sounds like it's got to be one of the top.
Yeah. We're the largest active virtual community in the world, which is wild to me because I was building this in a halfway house, you know, while trying to stay sober.
That's hilarious, dude.
That, like, I think this could help me. And
yeah. And
day one, what was really cool when it went live was there were like three people I didn't know using it day one, and there were like no marketing dollars behind it, nothing. And that made me really excited. I'm like, wow, three people are using it and they're all getting support.
Yeah.
And then even year one, like there was only like 50 people using it a day, the full first year of creating it. But that's what drove me is like, wow, like 50 people think that this app is a crucial part of their recovery journey. And now the fact that it's 400,000, I just can't really comprehend.
No, it's amazing, man. And it is truly like part of their recovery journey. And this is where those of us who've been around, you know, in recovery for a minute, I've been in recovery, it'll be 24 years in February, February 14th. But it's hard for us to understand that, right? Like we're so used to like a certain type of recovery experience where you got to go to a room and you got to have these principles written on the wall. And I'm not doubting that. I still do that to this day. But this is really, really, it's truly grabbing people with the same type of mentality, right? Mutual support. But it's virtual, but it's on this app. And now otherwise, what people can do on there is pretty normal for any other social media process, correct?
Yeah. I mean, if alcohol drugs aren't the problem, they're the solution, then engagement within this platform is about talking about the actual problem, which is like trauma or I had a bad day, or I got in a fight with my ex, or I had a great day. And, you know, these are all the things that we in recovery, sometimes the good moments are harder to process than the bad moments because we feel undeserving, or we feel like we're about to fuck it all up. And, you know, that's what engagement is about. You know, it's building that muscle. Like when we talk about mental health, you know, that's a conversation that is about treating disorders. But when we talk about mental fitness, that's about building those muscles. That's about those
just like physical fitness. Yep.
That keep you out of rehab, that keep you, you know, that keep you out off of antidepressants or, you know, or in addition to antidepressants.
Yes.
You know, these are the things, and I feel too much, you know, I think it's great that the stigma around mental health, it's still there and it's still super strong, but I think it's great that, you know, there's being progress being made. But one of the problems I see is, you know, there's, you know, this idea that people get where they aren't the ones who are solely responsible for their own mental health. And, you know, there's a little bit of an enablement because honestly, the health system, it wants you to be dependent on them for the mental health so that you keep coming back. And, you know, the fact is just like your physical fitness, a doctor can't make you eat right. A doctor can't make you work out. You know, all of that still comes down to you.
Well, and I'll tell you what, Chris, that is more that's becoming more and more mainstream every day. There's a little bit, and there's pushback from the establishment, like the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, all the traditional players, they don't really want to hear this. But the facts are that mental health goes way beyond psychiatric appointments and medication and talk therapy. It's the food you eat. It's whether or not you exercise on a daily basis. It's whether or not you get out in the sun. It's do you have any social? Yep. How much you sleep? My goodness, sleep. Yep.
How honest can you be with those friends you have?
Yep.
You know, one of my mentors, you know, he has a psychology degree as well, and he one of his instructors back when he was in school years ago had the honesty to say that the greatest threat to therapy is people having good friends.
That's a great statement.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not dissing therapy. You know, I utilize a therapist, you know, but it's what I utilize my therapist for.
Yes.
And, you know, it goes ebbs and flows, you know,
yeah.
I'll go 6 months without a therapist and then there'll be something very specific that I want to work on. And then I'll work with a therapist. But, you know, having a friend who you can be truly vulnerable with, who tells you, here's what I'm working on this week. Here's where my ego got in the way, you know, and yep. You can tell them where you fucked up, what your mistakes are. They'll show you your role in these things. You know,
they're also not going to run from you when you're in a grocery store. Like when you're a therapist, they teach you. I'm not making this up. Like one of the examples they have is if you run into a client at the grocery store, make sure you don't say hi to them. They have to. And I'm like, what? Like, really? Like your official ethical advice to me is that if I'm Chris's therapist and I see him in a grocery store, I'm supposed to ignore him. And how is that going to make Chris feel? Now I understand the principle behind that. They don't want me just walking up to you and being like, hey, what up, dude?
Like there's good reasons. There's good reasons.
But it's not human. It's just not human.
Yeah. 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 And to your point, you know, there's a transactional nature of therapy. You don't know if this person actually wants to be talking with you.
Oh, wow. Yeah, good point.
And, you know, you also don't know what their motivations are and what their incentives are. You know, for instance, the less you trust your family and, you know, the more you're going to trust them, the more dependent you're going to be on them, you know.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that all these things are, you know, it's just truly everyone has an agenda. I have an agenda. You have an agenda.
Yes.
It's just walking into it with, you know, eyes wide open. And, you know, and I don't want anyone to interpret this as dissing therapy because I utilize a therapy. I have a great therapist. It's knowing, you know, where your mental health begins and where therapy ends.
And being your own advocate. Being your own patient advocate. Unfortunately, we live in a world where I think you have to do that for even physical health issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't rely. But here's the other thing, Chris. I'll say this as a therapist. The other thing that I realized, because I went back to therapy school after I'd already been, you know, a professional working in the field. My undergraduate degree is in business management. Like I come from a family of entrepreneurs. I never thought I would be a therapist in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got into school, I was in like a cohort meeting with other people. We did every class together. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know these people really, really well. And here's the thing I can tell you, at least half of those folks, they should never be in a room alone with another human being, let alone be somebody's therapist. I mean, they're just not, it's like, have you ever met a school teacher who doesn't like kids?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, why did you pick this profession? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, a lot of people go into these jobs because it's sort of like, I always wanted to be a therapist and not understand the depth of the profession, if you will. And, mm-hmm. and that statement that you made, Chris, about you're never sure whether the person is talking to you because they want to or because they have to.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody ever does therapy with me and they feel that way, they should fire me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not cool. Think about that. Like, I get it, but that's, we got to do better as a profession.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then there's also like, you know, and if you look at, you know, the business world, you know, there's consultants you work with, there's agencies you work with. Like, if you hire a marketing agency, they're going to have nothing but good things to say about your product. They're going to have nothing but good things to say about your team. And, yep. And, you know, because their incentive is to make you feel really good about one thing so that your focus is on another thing. And, you know, you don't know. And they're also going to make you feel like you're their best friend and they think you're a genius, but you don't know if you weren't paying them, and you just met them on the street, they wouldn't necessarily have all those same great things to say about you.
No.
And that's where even that's where there's a challenge, because even if you are a good therapist, you know, and even if things are going well, there's the thought in the back of the patient's mind of, do I have a genuine relationship with this guy, or do I have a business relationship?
Yeah.
Guy.
And, yep. Well, it's so interesting, and we can kind of camp out here because it's fascinating, because as you learn about therapy, this is what they get at, Chris. Like, this is the core kind of like rub for people who practice. It's kind of like, can you enter into a deeply human relationship with Chris, even though it's in a professional context, and be able to bridge that gap? But the problem is, that's really hard. You know what I mean? Like, that's a very rare skill set that a lot of people just aren't going to be able to accomplish that. Does that make sense? Because they don't have the experience to do that.
Yeah.
It's like any other job. You got to do it for a while to get good at it. It's a high burnout profession as well.
Yeah. 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 And the majority of people who enter therapy, you know, it's after, you know, years of not therapy, years of not knowing what to look for.
Right.
Years of not knowing how to assess their own mental health. And, you know, so then there's the question, am I not doing it right? Am I doing it right? And, you know, is this what it looks like in the beginning? You know, just like any relationship, you know, do I need a bit more time? And, you know, all of this is not to dissuade anyone from getting therapy. It's just, you know, there's, you know, it's just like, you know, going out to eat. Like, is it great to go out to eat? You know, but is it also great to know how to cook?
Yeah.
And those aren't exclusive of each other.
That's right.
And, you know, you may never learn how to cook what your favorite restaurant cooks, but you may be able to learn how to, you know, build a great morning routine for yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And it's
I just read on a blog post where they were talking about, like, it was like one of those blog posts, like 7 keys to the new year or something. But one of the interesting things was talk about this movement of self therapy that's out there. And I'm not here to like advocate for it or not advocate for it. I don't know enough about it, but there have been a couple books that have been written, and it's this push up by therapists to teach people to therapize themselves. Pretty wild. It's some of the stuff you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And you look at therapy as one source of nutrition, just like, you know, it's not carbs or protein or vitamins. It's, you know, you need all of these things.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's what can be problematic is, you know, I think there is some arrogance in the clinical world of, you know, therapy is mental health. And it's a facet of mental health. It's a channel of mental health. It's, you know, but mental health is everything you do.
Yes.
Everything you do. And, you know, the belief that people have that, you know, their behaviors are determined by what medication they're on, or, you know, their ADD, you know, ADD diagnosis or clinical depression diagnosis or all these different things are what make you what you are.
Right.
And, And that's just not true, but I feel
it's not true at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even logical, because I could pull out the DSM-5, which is the diagnostic manual, and I could show you 7 different diagnostic profiles for 7 different diseases that all basically say the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you could meet criteria for depression, but you could also meet criteria for ADD, and you could also meet criteria for post-traumatic stress. It's like, it's a very inexact science, but we act as if it is, it's like precise, right? Like, I know exactly what's going on with you. You have depression. Here's your Prozac.
Yeah. And how many people have you met in your field where, their gateway drug was the Adderall that their psychiatrist prescribed?
I know.
And, you know, these are scenarios where, you know, there's a phrase, and I don't want to riff or rant too much, but here's a phrase I got from my favorite mentor, who I mentioned earlier, which is the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. Which is when you
fallacy of what? Say it again. Fallacy of
misplaced concreteness.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And it applies to economics, but it's like when you build it's like building a house on something you believe is concrete, but is actually quicksand. So, and it applies to economics. So it's just like you build something around the assumption that gold is infallible, or that like real estate is infallible, or these bold things that you believe to be concrete and then actually aren't, in the damage that comes out of, you know, believing something to be concrete that is not concrete. And I believe that is a huge, huge problem in behavioral health. You know, in that, you know, your diagnosis, you could talk to 5 psychiatrists every week for a month and get 5 different
diagnoses. Right.
And some of them are going to be good, and they're going to say, I'm not going to immediately prescribe you medication, and I'm going to try to get to know you better and like observe more before I decide you have this diagnosis and you need this medication. But too many people, you know, have been sent down a path when they were 7 years old.
Yeah.
And their parents didn't know better. They didn't know better. And now they built an entire lifelong dependency on something where it's like, oh, wait, it never came up that you have addiction in your family and
right. You
prescribed Adderall since you were 12. And now you're on meth.
Like, yeah.
But this was the clinical recommendation, and that family trusted that they were getting great clinical advice from a clinician. And it's just being honest about what we don't know. Like, astronauts know how to get to the moon. They don't know how to get to Mars. And if they tell you they have a way for you to get to Mars tomorrow and you get the ship, you're going to die because they don't know how to get to Mars.
But we've been told, see the problem, like you're 100% on point. It's interesting though, when you look at it, we've been told by those of us that have been practicing in the field for a while, we've been told that we're right. Like, we've been told that we're infallible. I mean, think about it. From an addiction treatment perspective, think about how it works. Chris, you come into my program and you are supposed to have hit bottom and do exactly what I tell you to do. And if you do what I tell you to do, then you will be successful. You will stay sober and I will have a win. But if you don't, it's not on me. It's on you. It's because you didn't take, I am in a situation where I can only win. Does that make sense? You can't. There's nothing I can do wrong as a provider because it's all about Chris's willingness. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we did at U-Turn Health early on when we would go to the addiction treatment conferences, we don't go to addiction treatment conferences anymore because, well, that's obvious. But at any rate, when we used to go, we would have a big sign that said willingness not required. Mm-hmm. And people would walk by, and most of the time what was wild is we would get a good response. Do you know what I mean? Like, most of the time people would go, that's cool. But we would have some people that would come up and you would think that we just said, I don't know, that we just blasphemed against some kind of religion or something. It is dogmatic and it is offensive to people for us to say stuff like that. Mm. But willingness is not required. Willingness is not a prerequisite for drug and alcohol treatment.
Yeah. And also blind trust, you know?
Right.
Like, for instance, my first sponsor that I had before I got sober, you know, I realized as someone early in recovery that I don't think I want what this guy has. And I don't, what he's saying doesn't add up to me. And I think I need to move on and find a different sponsor. And, you know, unfortunately, I lost touch with him, but unfortunately, you know, I heard like a month ago that he died.
Oh, shoot.
And, yeah. It's the idea that anyone has all the answers, that we just have to stay away from, you know, because if you go to a treatment center, everyone lives their recovery differently, yeah. You know, everyone period lives their recovery differently.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's about taking what works for you, being open-minded, taking what works for you. But, you know, the belief that, or the arrogance to say, you know, if you do exactly what I prescribe for you to do, you're going to be okay. That's just arrogance, in my opinion.
Yeah. And it's even worse if you say that's the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. That not only if you do it my way, will you be fine, but my way is really the only way. Because that was exactly what I was told. I mean, I was 100% told, you come back when you want it, dude. And, you know, hey, when you're willing to do what I say. And I tried 3 or 4 times before I finally got sober.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, it was the luck of the draw. I just happened to vibe with the dude that was sponsoring me. Like, no rhyme or reason to it. Probably the 4th or 5th sponsor I had, just for whatever reason, mm-hmm. I could talk to this guy. And he didn't even, the dude was a general manager at a Panera Bread. He worked like 85 hours a week. He would fall asleep sometimes when I was talking to him. I don't even know why I liked the guy. But it's weird. It's like that God thing or serendipity. Oh, right place, right time. Right. Well, that's not how it should work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can't rely on serendipity to like end this epidemic. It's got to be a little bit more sophisticated than that.
Yeah. Yeah, which is what we're trying to do with Sober Sidekick is, you know, 100x the number of at-bats.
Because, that's exactly right.
You know, there's not a formula for hitting a home run every single time, but we got to get the reps up and we got to get, you know, the fact that the best case scenario for a subset of our population is 1 hour of therapy a week, or maybe they're in an outpatient for a period of time, but it's still like the moments of recovery, the moments that change behavioral health happen outside of that. And
yeah,
and it's about repetition. If you want to change your life, it's about habits, and you are the one who, it's on you.
Yep. It's a lot about, it's about the social aspect of it, is, and having a tribe as well. Mm-hmm. And people that say good job, right? And it's like, if you look at what's posted on Sober Sidekick, you know, it's joyful stuff, you know, it's like, and there's struggles too, don't get me wrong, but it's like somebody will have a picture of some kind of accomplishment that they just had, and everybody will be like, good job. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not somebody posting up in there like, I just finished my cognitive restructuring exercise on my thinking errors related to my childhood when I was, you know,
relapse prevention worksheet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I, that's important stuff. As you've said, mm-hmm. that is important stuff. And we need to have the whole package, but we got to have this. And a lot of times, man, this is more important, whatever this is, whether it's the social support or the attaboys, or I know in my world, it was more important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we both agree that, and there are studies that show this, that positive motivation is way stronger than negative motivation. And like one analogy I like to use is, if someone's hanging by one hand on the edge of a cliff and you remind them, hey, if you fall, you're going to die. If you don't hold on much longer, you're going to die. If you remind them what happens if they let go, that's not really going to help them.
That's not helpful.
But what motivates them is what they're fighting for, you know, and, you know, your family wants to see you like on the other side, you know, all, you know, your dreams, your goals, your, like, these are the things that motivate people to stay sober.
Yep.
You know, is looking up, not down. And I feel we build everything around, like, don't people know that if they don't use clean needles, that they might get hep C? And it's like, well, didn't they know before that, like, they can overdose from drugs? Yeah. People know these things. Like, I knew the damage I was doing. I didn't need to be reminded of the damage I was doing. What I needed was a reason to believe that I could ever change.
Yep. You know? Yep. You need a little bit of hope. You've got to have hope. You got to have, and that's been studied. That is one of the consistent, like, kind of qualities. You got to have hope, and you can get hope from a lot of different places. But one of the places you can get it without question is Sober Sidekick. Now, what's the future of Sober Sidekick hold? Like, what are your, it's 400,000 users strong. How long has it officially been in existence? 5 years?
5 years.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
what happens next?
98 minus 60 days.
Okay. All right. Easy enough to remember.
Yeah. So I can just say, well, I stayed sober for 5 years and I have Sober Sidekick. So no,
that's right. It's 100% successful. That's correct.
No, that's exactly what we were talking about. Doesn't work, which is saying there's,
that's right.
But yeah, what our big goal is, you know, there's a Harvard case study about our decision to cut off our first 1 million and only revenue at the time. That was coming from fee for service providers, because I went into that business model with the assumption that most are bad and our few are good, and came out with the belief that there's some good ones out there. I'm sure, I just haven't met them yet.
Nope.
You know, what we realized is, like, if we scale this model, we're perpetuating this fee for service world. And, you know, in this world, there's no financial incentive for sustained sobriety. So, you know, we made the decision, which I honestly thought it was 2 years ago. I thought it might be the last decision I made before this company went under, was, you know, while we had a potential lead investor tell us they'd lead our round if we were willing to scale it, was burning the boats and deciding, like, we got to find a better way. And, you know, so in terms of our big scary goal is to shift the entire space away from fee for service and create a world where incentives are truly driven by long-term success and long-term outcomes.
Yeah.
One of the reasons we believe we're in a position to do it, or at least have the fool's hope that we could do it, is we actually have more data than anyone in the world on long-term sobriety and long-term recovery and long-term engagement. And, you know, more relapses are reported to us than anyone in healthcare. So we're able to look at the data and see the themes and who relapses and who doesn't, you know. I see a world in the future where providers should only be getting paid based off of how many of their patients are still sober a year later.
They keep saying that that's going to happen. I mean, that's been, you know, value-based care has been talked about for 10 plus years. If they would just make a move toward it, I feel like it would be a significant change, man. I feel like model that you just described right there, where people are accountable for outcomes, it's so logical.
Yeah. And I believe the gap is that payers are dependent on providers for outcomes data.
Okay.
And obviously incentives are not aligned there. And that's why coming in as a third party, non-biased source of, also the provider doesn't know what happens after 30 days or after you've left. They don't even know anyway. So they can't report on what they don't know, but we know. And we can, So, you know, that I believe is the biggest gap from the aspirations versus reality is payers don't have engagement directly with the population in order to know what's working and what's not.
Do you think they even like that is, well, payers, if you look at the provider world, the provider world doesn't, I've said this for years. They don't really know what's going on with addiction and recovery. They only know what's going on with a small slice of the pie, the people who show up and are willing to do what they need to do, right? Like that, if you look at your local IOP or your local rehab, that's all they can speak to is that one small group. You have a cross section of people at various levels of recovery and levels of use. That's where the actual knowledge is. Does that make sense? If I'm talking to the same basic patient every time, I'm not learning anything about addiction and recovery. I'm just learning what works for Rich. Mm-hmm. I'm the prototypical patient. When I went into recovery, I was literally like demographically the average patient. I was a middle-aged white dude. Like literally, I am the demographic. I walked into a room, everybody looked like me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I had a car, I had insurance, I had all the things I needed to do to get better. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they know. They know what to do with Rich. Mm-hmm. Okay. What about all these other, like, I do not represent everybody in recovery, man.
Yeah.
Not like
so one rant I want to go on real quick is back when I was raising, I met with a VC where their thesis is funding my companies, minority companies who are focused on minority problems. And you know, it was a white guy who like took the pitch with me, and he told me at end of the day, love what you're doing, but we feel that your business doesn't disproportionately affect minorities.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hold on a second. You know, you're telling me that. You're basing that off of who is walking into rehab right now, who is being covered for rehab right now, versus who is getting jail time for the same exact problem. You know, and you're basing that off of who has the financial means to leave their kids for 30 days and sit in California for rehab for, you know, and,
yep,
you know, and you're telling me that this doesn't disproportionately affect minorities. And I was just, that's
ridiculous. That's funny, dude. I'm sorry.
I burned that bridge in my email back to him. So every once in a while, you just got to burn a bridge. So.
Just got to burn a bridge, man, no matter what.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. First of all, I'm stunned that an hour has flown by already, brother. I could continue this conversation. I feel like you and I could probably talk about this stuff all day. Tell us where folks can find the app and any other information about Sober Sidekick.
Yeah. Download in the App Store, Google Play. It'll work on any smartphone, and just search Sober Sidekick. Feel free to read the reviews before you make a decision or just go ahead with it. But you know, what you'll find here is that you're never alone. And that's what we're here to show you is, you know, and that's what I recognize was what held me back for so long was that feeling that I'm alone, dealing with this, that feeling that I can't open up about this. And, you know, you can be 100% anonymous. Every time you speak up, someone's going to reach out to you. That's the magic of it. You know, you can also join a 24/7 AA meeting at any point in time.
I saw that. Now, how does that? So that's I see that's a Zoom link, right? Like you hit that and it'll take you to an external meeting.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what we're here is for. For the moments, for the good moments, the bad moments, you know, is, you know, you put yourself out there and you deserve to be met with empathy and hope every single time.
And
this is your comeback story. So,
yep. And everybody out there, I would highly recommend it. Like I have test driven a lot of apps. This is the first one I've actually like recommended. And it's got users and it's a real like live community, guys. So check it out. And it needs people from all different journeys. Like it's not just new people in recovery. I'm on there. I got 24 years, so on and so forth. So check it out. It's Sober Sidekick. Just hit up the App Store and you can find it. Good stuff, Chris. Thank you very much for joining us. And everybody out there, thank you for being with us on You Learn, You Turn, and we will talk to you soon.